Welcome to the June edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor, and later on I'll be joined by my colleagues from Garden Organic, Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld. Well, May had some surprises in store for us, didn't it? At Wrighton, a rare sighting of sun got us all excited until the downpours returned. But on the upside, we've been making great use of our new rain garden, which fills up and drains away very efficiently, slowing down the water flow. More on that in a future edition of the podcast. Later on, we'll be answering your questions about how to deal with box hedge moth, what to do about allotment-loving ants, and how to tackle chilies that aren't hot. This time, we've got an interview special on water saving. We're first joined by Jo Osborne from the charity Waterwise, then by climate change gardening guru Sally Morgan. Before all that, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Andermatt Garden. We're using their plastic-free insect netting at our demonstration garden. The netting's made from plants, so it's completely biodegradable. And they also supply beneficial insects along with other sustainable products. They've given us a 15% discount code for our listeners. Just visit their website, andermattgarden.co.uk. That's andermattgarden.co.uk. And enter the code ORGANIC15 and you'll get 15% off. And now I'm off to join Chris in our virtual potting shed.
Hi, Chris, how are you?
I'm very well, Fiona. A little bit wet, a little bit soggy and wet, but on the whole, I'm good.
That's where I'm at as well. I mean, you know, I was looking out the window the other day and I've got two or three bay trees, little standards they were when I put them in. They've bulked up quite nicely, but they've sent out these kind of spurs of leaves and they were very floppy. And you know how bay is quite a kind of stiff plant. And I know the young foliage is lovely and soft. But I've never seen it like this, where I've got these kind of sprays coming out of the centre of the plant. And when the rain's on them, it almost looks like a weeping bay tree. It's extraordinary. I mean, the rain has really, really taken charge, hasn't it, frankly?
It's not just the rain, is it? It's not been cold. You know, I was doing some planting yesterday and it was really raining hard, but I wanted to be in shorts. I had a t-shirt.
Oh, tropical.
I was warm. So, yeah, it was very humid and warm. And I'd actually dug the area over about 2 weeks before. And it was quite weedy, but nothing too drastic. And the regrowth has just been phenomenal, where obviously the weeds are sitting there going, well, the soil's warm, it's wet. It's quite, you know, I'm ready to go here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So those native plants, those ones that are most comfortable in those that environment are really putting on the growth quite quickly.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the difficulty is that, you know, for the times you need to pull things out in order to plant other things in their place, these great clods of earth are coming with them. So it's a difficult to work your way through the beds and you know, and pick your way through. And obviously, don't want to strip the bed completely bare anyway. So trying to go quite carefully and trying not to disturb the soil too much. But these great clods of earth coming out with them.
Yes, well, I've got a lot of coach grass on the allotment and we talk about no dig, but in some bits of it, I there's no way I can't not get a fork in it. It would just take over. But quite a good tip is, obviously, I wear steel-toe cap boots when I'm working, is if you get a clump of a big clump of leaves, just stick your right foot out or your left and just bang that root ball on the end of that steel-toe cap and let the soil come off and try to leave as much of it as possible on the soil, yeah. And then, obviously, that then goes into, unless it's the roots, which are pernicious, that then goes onto my compost heap as well. But you're right. I mean, my allotment looks good at the moment. There's a lot of stuff going on in it. All my salad crops are doing all right. My brassicas look like they're doing all right. There's things going on. My tomatoes look like they're doing all right. But there's a lot of weed. The weed are out competing. So I might not be there for a week because I gallivant around the place. And then so I'm always feeling a little bit, because of the climate this year, because of the wet, warm weather, it's always felt like I'm a little bit behind. So I'm kind of looking forward, to be honest with you, to have a couple of really solid days on it, which I'll try and do this bank holiday weekend. And also in my front room, I've got my courgettes, my runner beans, my pumpkin, my squash, are all sitting in containers in ready to go. So I want to get all those in as well. I feel like I'm playing catch up a bit, Fiona. That's what it feels like.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I'm feeling a bit disheartened, I have to say. And, you know, it has got away from me. And every year I think, no, it won't get away from me this year. But it was just the weather. It really genuinely was the weather. And every time I had the time to go out and do it, it was just pouring with rain. And, you know, I should have just gone and done it anyway, I suppose. But, you know, I'm slightly paying the price. But on the other hand, you know, I think the weather has been cooler. As you say, it's got quite warm and humid now, but it was cooler for so long that actually there is time to catch up. Certainly, you know, there's time to sow and grow. And also the advantage is that the bird life has just been phenomenal this spring. I mean, have you felt that too?
Yeah, I think the wildlife are enjoying it. Certainly the mollusks are, because we had a right
time. Well,
there isn't anybody not listening to this podcast who isn't going, yeah, the mollusks, yeah.
Yeah, it's just everywhere.
Yeah, I think it's been a great year for them. Someone will be benefiting from that. It might be birds, might be frogs. You know, you don't know, do you? But I think they benefit from not having that. The last few years, we've had a really hot, little burst of hot spring, haven't we? Everything was really dry. So I think the wildlife's benefited from a slightly warmer, I know it's been cooler earlier in the year, but slightly warmer late spring. And I think that the bird life particularly, there's a lot of small insectivorous life about, especially with me up in the trees here, that I think they're very much benefiting. I've got the house martins at the moment. They always turn up same time of year and they eat on the wing. And I had about 70 of them last night, all above the canopy of the trees, looking like they're having a veritable feast, Fiona, without a doubt.
Oh, lovely. I love that, though. Don't you? Just love it.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to sit there and watch the telly, but I'm more watching the house martin. I'm just pulled away from it. And, I can't fault that. I just think if you're growing food, which gardening-wise, horticultural-wise, is one of the most difficult things to do because it's more susceptible to climate than a shrubbery or an herbaceous border or, you know, it's more vulnerable. So I think it just means your challenges are greater, so you have to concentrate on it a bit more. And I think that this year has definitely had its challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, I mean, I just, you know, you step out the back door and they're everywhere. Because everything's wet, there's nothing stopping them. They're just everywhere.
It rained for like 24 hours this week. And I'm always talking about my stick-on bird feeder on the window. I'm three floors up and there were two snails on it last night.
Yes.
they're mountaineering to get the food. Yes. It's quite amazing. But, you know, I'd rather have that burst of life I'll try to save some food for myself and my good lady.
Yes, I know. It's part of the observation, isn't it? Because I do actually find them totally fascinating. I think they're extraordinary creatures and there's so many different types of them. Yeah, okay, there's nothing more annoying when you've reared a plant and put it out and it's just destroyed. But then, as we say, you know, it's down to the conditions, it's down to the weather, but it's down to time as well, Chris. I don't know about you, but, you know, just putting that time in.
I think that what we probably need, sounds like both of us, is just maybe a real good session on it. I'm going to do it, I think, Sunday, Monday. I think I'm just going to go for it. I'll be happy, you know, doing that as well. You know, I really will. I've said it many, many times. You don't want to get it on top of you. You just want to go and have a good session on it. And then you come away feeling better and you feel like things are back in order. And I'm sure we'll take plenty of food out of our gardens again, as usual. I believe that will certainly catch up.
The other thing is that, as you said, you've still got plenty of plants to go in. But there's still loads of time to sow. I mean, loads of time to sow. What are you doing on that?
Well, I never stop really through the summer. You know, you might have situations where your salad crops, your lettuce, your rocket starts to bolt. So I'm always backing up then with sowings as well. Radish, I still, every 6 weeks I can take a radish crop. I love a peppery radish in my salad. So brassicas still, so if I can get a continuation of those. If you can sow runner beans, French beans, field beans, anything like that, all the way up until July, really, they're fast growing plants. If you get them into warm soil, they will come. So if you have had mollusk damage and you have lost some plants, just go again. Maybe one little tip I'll give you is maybe grow them a bit bigger before you plant them out, so the lignin in the leaves is there and they're a bit more tougher, and then the sort of slugs and the snails not quite so keen on them. But yeah, don't think that, you know, we have this big glut of sowing in the spring. I'm guilty as anything for that. But I then start to perpetuate, let it roll, keep sowing. And you've got to remember, I mean, seeds are not, in the grand scheme of things, very expensive. A packet of rocket seed, you know, I sowed some night-scented stock, which is one of my favourite plants.
Yes.
I love sitting in the evening, glass of wine with that pot near you. It's just amazing. But you get like 400 seeds in a packet, same with rocket. And so, you know, get your seed collection together. And make sure that if things are failing, it's not the end of the world. You can re-sow and keep planting. You've got all summer to do that. All summer.
Yeah. And actually, one of my very favourite flowers is rocket flowers. They're beautiful.
Yes, the crucifer. Yeah, actually, the bees as well love them, especially the solo bees. They really, really enjoy them. So, if they start to bolt, let them give that to the pollinators and just sow another couple of drills. It's not a problem.
Have you got any concerns after all this wet weather?
Well, I've been... 40 years at it now, and I think that, to me, the climate doesn't feel the same. That's very difficult to gauge, though, because we kind of remember what happened last year, maybe the year before. But the climate feels a little bit different to me. I worry about how wet it is. Something's causing it to be really, really damp. But then maybe next year I'll be saying, well, it's too dry. I don't know. But I certainly think that it's providing me with more challenges than I've had previously. I just think that things have... I'm more of a weatherman now than I used to be, it feels like. I used to be able to rely on the seasons a bit more. And I think the lines are blurring a bit. That's how it feels to me.
What about crops that might have been affected by the wet weather?
Where is it? Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to happen. If you like things like I always love my Mediterranean plants, the chilies and the aubergines and the tomatoes. Even if you don't get the wet, if you don't get the sunshine, they're not going to ripen really. But it might be so that I take other crops like the brassicas do better. I don't know. I think that depending on the amount of sunshine, that will affect how much crop you're taking off stuff, really.
If you've got fruit trees, Chris, what should you be doing right now?
Well, some gardeners like to thin them, so you get sort of a more sort of the crop is less but more dense, larger. Peach trees, obviously, very, very vulnerable to any kind of cold snaps, as are most fruit trees. But I think it seems to have been quite a good year for fruit, because the apples where I was yesterday, actually, there's a little orchard there, or actually covered. So I think when it gets to this stage, there's probably not much you can do apart from thin out, I reckon.
Right.
Obviously, you might get aphid problems. One of the tips these days, which one I like talking about, is make sure you have rot holes, like a bit of old wood with a decaying piece in the centre where maybe a bough's come off. That's good for earwigs and stuff like that. They'll have a little go at the aphid. Bird life, you've already mentioned. So you might want to just make sure that wildlife's around to sort of maybe pick off any aphids or anything. Oh, I looked at all the soft fruit yesterday on the site I was on. It's a good idea to make sure you prune them properly in the late winter so you get all that fresh new growth, and that sort of provides the fruit. These ones hadn't been touched this year, a bit more gnarly. All the fruit tended to be heavy on the top end of the plant. So pruning plays a big role in it as well.
Okay, so make a note for next year if you haven't done it. Okay. Any pests you need to look out for on fruit trees this time of year?
Well, certainly aphid. I mean, you don't really want the woolly aphid. That can cause all sorts of problems, but certainly aphid. I mean, aphids are quite remarkable creatures. If they're asexual in the summer, so they don't need to breed with other aphids. They can produce an aphid singly. In fact, that they reckon you can chop an aphid in half and you can have three generations of aphid inside the aphid. And so you want to kind of keep on top of them this year. Blue tits, brilliant way to do it. Get some bird boxes, get some blue tits into the garden as well. If you are not creating a wildlife area or having wildlife in your garden, those things like aphids are bound to be more prolific because there's no competition. So the more competition you can introduce, the better.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm very lucky. I've got blue tits and great tits in the garden, and goldfinch. They seem to be really doing a great job. And I put up a bird box a couple of years ago. I think the first year nothing happened, and we just thought, oh well, you know, it's not going to happen. And then last year we had a great tit, and again this year we've just noticed activity back and forth. It's so exciting having that. It really is. It's just such a simple thing, you know, just a simple bird box.
Yeah, just so much good. And they will hoover up. They will hoover up caterpillar, aphid. They'll pick those things off.
It was such a triumph because Graham went away and kind of, you know, did all the measuring and did all the research and, you know, sighted this bird box at a certain height on the tree, and nothing happened. And then the next year, bingo. So, you know, it's great. It's great. It's so encouraging. But as you say, they'll be feasting on those aphids. And they also like the old box caterpillars, blue tits. So, you know, they've got their uses, definitely. And they're a joy to have around. And, you know, they really are a joy to have around. There's lots of them in my neck of the woods. It's lovely. I have got a very soggy herb garden, as I described at the beginning. My bay trees are looking rather sorry for themselves, almost like weeping bay trees. It's incredibly verdant, you know, an enormous amount of leafage from the perennial herbs, the marjoram, the oregano, the rosemary bushes are just enormous. You know, they just get bigger and bigger each year. They're just fantastic. And I just kind of let them do that. They sort of cloud out, you know, and they're still flowering. They've flowered for months.
Yeah, they're flowering really, Rosemary. Yeah, blue.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I've seen them flowering in Jerusalem in the snow in the middle of the winter.
Wow.
They're quite amazing plants. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a bit of lovage going very well. Just an awful lot of wild strawberry that is sort of multiple.
Yeah.
But it's a welcome. It's a welcome guest, I have to say. You know, you can't go wrong with wild strawberries, can you? Just so delicious. And then chives are doing well. They've bulked up nicely. So, you know, these perennial herbs are a total joy because it's kind of no effort. And you're popping out there all the year round and able to put sort of fresh things on top of your cooking. I love sowing basil this time of year. I think that's possibly the most satisfying summer herb. You can't have too much basil. It's as simple as that. You know, just keep sowing it. Let it really bulk up. Allow those basil leaves, homegrown basil leaves, get the leaves get really big and they still taste. If you buy those basil plants from a supermarket, when the leaves get too big, they run out of flavour. But when you grow it yourself, it's just something else. And the other thing about basil is they're quite fun to grow as little microgreens.
Yeah.
Have you done that, Chris?
Yeah, I have. I do a lot of microgreen sowing. So, you can rotate them in every couple of weeks, you see, with other crops. I'll tell you what else is good is chard as a microgreen, radish as a microgreen. So I think if you just put them on the windowsill, can't you, and grow them. And like you say, if you're going to get a ready grown one from the supermarket, that would have been hydroponically produced. So it wouldn't have been grown in soil, mass scale. It's not the same as growing something yourself, is it?
So, Chris, this is the time of year where you're out and about a lot. I know you do a lot of talking to gardening clubs and you know, you talk at the shows and things. Busy diary at the moment?
Yeah, very. I'm had a great time at Malvern. I was gardening Crest in Time with the Toby Bucklands and the Alan Titchmarsh and the great and the good. Felt quite special for a couple of days.
Very good. Oh, don't let it get to your head.
No, the best part of that, though, was I'm the school gardening champion. So there were 12 school gardens there that were just phenomenal this year. They were really, really good. I'm so proud to be involved in that. There's a lot of love and happiness that goes on around it. Obviously, got Gardens World coming up. I'm due a little bit of a break, to be honest with you.
And the allotment is calling, isn't it? And we'll all still be here when you get back. And the allotment will be delighted to see you. It'd be interesting to see how much catching up we can get done in June between us, both in my garden and in your allotment. It does feel like we've got to do quite a bit of catching up. I think both of us feel way behind. So, you know, here's to catching up in July, and hopefully by then we've got on top of it.
Yeah, I reckon we will. I've got every confidence, Fiona.
Before this month's podcast, I thought I was clued up on the world of water saving. I save my rainwater at home, and we have various water collecting methods at our organic demonstration garden here in Coventry. So I was somewhat surprised to find out that in the UK, we could be on our way towards a water deficit. I spoke with Joe Osborne from the charity Waterwise about the seriousness of this problem, and climate change gardener and friend of Garden Organic, Sally Morgan, who offers practical advice for water saving in our growing plots.
Okay, Joe. All right. So tell us a little bit about Waterwise. What kind of organisation is it?
Right. We are the leading independent voice in the UK for using water wisely. So we describe ourselves as being like the UK's conscience on water efficiency. And that's on behalf of people and the planet. It's very much a environment and people issue with water efficiency. So our team itself is made up of experts on a range of areas. So we've got people who are focused on water efficiency policy, regulation, research, and then also water use and behaviour change and how people are using water. Our vision at Waterwise is that water is used wisely every day, everywhere, by everyone.
That's a great mission, isn't it? Really simple. And actually, the fact that we need an organisation called Waterwise suggests that we haven't been using it wisely. And I'd just like to explore that a bit. I mean, what is the level of scarcity and how's it come about?
Latest evidence from the Environment Agency is indicating that if we did nothing, there was no action taken, in England, we face a potential water deficit by 2050 of close to 5,000 million litres of water every day.
Let's just stop and actually visualise what water scarcity really means, because a water deficit isn't a phrase I've really heard or stopped to think about before. Mm. And I'm trying to imagine what that actually looks like. If you've got a 500 million litre deficit per day, then
it sounds to me like that is the end of switching your tap on for water supply.
It wouldn't be that you wouldn't be able to switch your taps on, but it's that there would be periods of time where you wouldn't be able to, because the time it takes to treat water and pump it through the system, get it to people's taps, getting that amount of water to people becomes a problem. So there would be a lot more risks of drought. And a key problem with it is around growth. It would mean that businesses can't set up in an area because there's not resource available for them, or houses can't be built in an area because there's not the water for them.
Have we got a stat on how much water we use every day now?
Across the UK, the average water use per person is about 142 litres of water per person per day.
How does that work? I can't imagine that I use that much.
It is an average use. So bearing in mind, there are going to be some people who are using way more than that. There are also people who are using less than that. But if you think about where you're using water across the home, every time you're flushing the loo, that's 5 litres of water being flushed down the loo. A bath is about 70 litres of water. Washing clothes, dishwashers. And then outdoor use, people are using water for washing their cars, cleaning windows, hosing down patios, that sort of thing. So it is amazing how much can get added up. And the other area with it is that also includes, like, in our homes, we do have issues with like plumbing leaks. So there's a lot of areas where we're sort of using water, and then areas where water's being wasted without us even necessarily even realizing it. And all of that adds up to then having this average. Really, we should be looking at having below 100 litres as an average.
I can see people getting on board with that messaging. If people knew what actions they could take to reduce their water usage, I think people generally be more than happy to pitch in. You know, you've just described that we use water in our homes. You know, we might have a bath, or we might be more conscious and try and have a short shower. But one of the things about using water outside, you know, we're washing our cars in drinking water. It's a bit bonkers, isn't it?
Yes, the future really needs to be about how we can make better use of rainwater harvesting, grey water reuse as well. And the good news is there's a lot of organisations are beginning to innovate in these areas. And also the government's taking a bit more action now as well on some of these things. So there's quite a lot of pilot projects and things happening in the Cambridge area at the moment, because there's quite a pressure on there where they're needing to build new houses and develop for innovation in that area. And so it's sort of being used as a bit of a test bed for innovations and things. So although the numbers with the water deficit in the future is rightly worrying, the positive is that actually we've got the tools and we can make sure that there's enough water for people and the environment in the future. But it's important that we know about how much water we're using. Do you know how much water you use a day?
Absolutely not. I don't. I've never measured it. I've never stopped to think about it. I mean, I am careful as much as I can, and I'm particularly careful in the garden. And, you know, I collect my own water, and, you know, I try to water with watering cans rather than a hose pipe, so that you can be much more targeted about your watering. And, you know, it's better for the plants anyway. I remember my grandfather rigging up a hose pipe from his washing machine into a tank in the garden. And then he watered his vegetable garden with the runoff from the washing machine. It's not difficult to collect your own rainwater or collect your own grey water and actually rely more on that than on mains water, I guess.
Yeah, I think those opportunities to collect rainwater, if you're lucky enough to have your own home and a garden, then fitting a water butt should be one of the first things that someone does when they set up their home and their garden. I think there should be more work done to ensure that landlords are giving their tenants the opportunities to be able to use water in that way as well, and reduce their own water bills too. So there's definitely steps that we can take to make our own impact through rainwater harvesting. Grey water reuse, yes, is something to be conscious of the products that you're using in your washing machines. So you have to be careful about what the grey water is that you're using, and then where you're using it as well. Another key area then is knowing your water use yourself. So if you don't already have a water meter, asking a water company for a water meter to be fitted.
And where would you suggest people make a start? The top things you could do, no matter what kind of property you live in, what would you suggest?
talked a little bit about the water use in the kitchen. You were saying about your granddad with the machine. Any of the appliances that you're using that are using water, just make sure you're using them to their best of their ability. So full loads on your washing machines, full loads on dishwashers, so that you're maximizing that water as it's being used. You know, you don't need to like rinse off all your plates before you put them in the dishwasher. You know, scrape off the food into your food waste, but put the plates and things straight into the dishwasher and the dishwasher will do the job. You don't need to run them under taps to clear them off a bit first, which I think is something that quite a few people do. And if you're washing up at home, use a washing up bowl rather than the big sink, because you'll just use less water instantly by doing that.
One of the things that I know my sister does, for example, is it takes quite a long time for her hot water to come through. So she always fills her watering can from the hot tap while she's waiting for it to heat up, which is again another thing where, you know, you're just standing there waiting for it to get warm, and that's just another huge waste, isn't it?
Yes, it's a really important point. Waiting for your shower to heat up, waiting for the hot tap to heat up is definitely an area where we do see water basically going to waste. So yeah, things like that, having a jug nearby that you can use to fill that up, for your watering can in the garden. I've got like my pot plants at the side in the bathroom. I always hold it under the shower as it's heating up. So I sort of like give it a little shower. So that's my way of doing that in the bathroom.
So one of the things at the moment that is in the press all the time is sewage in our rivers. Water companies are coming under an increasing amount of pressure to resolve this issue. There's talk even about renationalising water companies. There's all sorts of information that's out there at the moment about whether we could trust our water supply and the damage that is occurring to our natural environment from our domestic supply. So I just wondered if that's an area of campaigning that you get involved in.
Yeah, so at Waterwise, like our focus really is on that stage of the water resources coming into our homes and businesses, and how we can make the best use of that to benefit the environment. And that said, we don't want to see sewage in rivers, and it's certainly something that we agree that it's quite right that there's being a call to stop seeing that being released into waterways. There's a great organisation called Blueprint for Water, which is a coalition of environmental NGOs focused on rivers, the environment, wildlife, and Waterwise is part of that coalition. So we come in with our thoughts around how water efficiency can help make a difference, whereas those other organisations have got a bit more of the understanding of the environmental impact and messages around that side of things. I do think that water efficiency itself has got a really important part to play. Yes. In all of this, because you know, if we can use less water, and especially that water that's like coming down in huge storm events and things, if that water's being slowed in our gardens, if we're collecting it in water butts and things like that, it all helps to reduce the amount that's flowing into sewers in the first place.
It does feel to me as though some of this is going to have to be enshrined in law. And I know that you are involved in policy work. Can you tell us a bit about that?
There has been some important steps recently to take more of a focus on water efficiency opportunities through government. So through the Environment Act, they have created a roadmap for water efficiency with a number of steps of things that are being put in place to make a change to some of our legislation. Personally, I think is a really important one is around our building regulations. So where we're building new properties, making sure that those homes in the first place are designed to be water efficient, so that a family moving in, it's not something they even have to think about. It naturally happens. People don't realize actually everything that's gone on behind the scenes to get water that's safe for you to drink.
Okay. Well, Jo, that's really interesting. Thank you so much. It's been really fascinating to talk to you and to stop and think about even those elements of water use that hadn't occurred to me. And water wastage that hadn't occurred to me. I thought I was fairly well informed, and I've realised I'm really not. And this notion of us heading towards potentially a water deficit is not what I want for my own grandchildren. Thank you so much, Jo, for joining us.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Now, we've just heard from Jo at Waterwise about water scarcity and the water deficit. So we decided to get in touch with our friend Sally Morgan, who is hugely experienced in gardening, in climate change, and has an enormous amount of expertise around sustainability. I'm here with Sally now to give us some practical advice on water use in the garden. Sally, first of all, you know, if we carry on using water the way we are, WaterWise has told us that we face a deficit of 5 billion litres per day by 2050. And so therefore we have to change. On an individual level, we get through 142 litres per person per day at the moment, and we need to get that down. I believe you've just come back from Spain, and I'd be really interested to start there with how they are coping and what sort of changes they're having to make.
Yeah. Hi. I went to just north of Barcelona, and they have experienced effectively 3 years of drought or very low rainfall. Okay. And normally with a Mediterranean climate, they would have quite cold but damp winters, which will replenish their reservoirs, and then they can fill all their swimming pools in spring again and water everything. So the background is they're used to quite low water, but having experienced 3 years of virtually no water, the reservoirs have drained out. There has been no replenishing. It's interesting to walk around some of the towns. I went into Barcelona, which has a vast tree planting scheme underway, and the trees were looking quite sad. Yes. And there are signs up saying, apologies for the appearance of our planting, apologies for the trees. They haven't been able to water them. So until these last rains came, nobody was allowed to water through a pipe, fill up a swimming pool, all those types of things that would conserve water. The rains did come, albeit late, and they've been allowed to do that now. So they're just beginning to behave normally in spring. But the worry is they are getting torrential rain as opposed to gentle rain, 4 or 5 inches of rain in some places, which means that a lot of that valuable rain runs straight off the pavement, straight off into their storm drains and out into the Mediterranean. So they're not capturing as much water in their reservoirs.
So what can be done?
For them, they are looking at huge restrictions. It's difficult to say. They have a problem. They're already doing all the right things. They have drought-adapted planting. They've got lots of cover for their plants. They are trapping water in reservoirs. They are not using quality potable water in their gardens. So the next thing they have to look at is grey water. And so staying with my friend, she said, oh, there's a bucket in the shower. Don't worry, she said. When the shower runs, fill up the bucket until it runs hot, and we use that bucket to flush the loo.
Yeah.
Simple things. They're saving 20 litres of water a day to save flushing. So it is little things and big things in terms of reservoirs and consumers cutting right back, planting things that can cope with virtually no water. Mm-hmm. Very tricky. And she's, as I say, in Costa Brava. If you go further down the coast towards Africa, the conditions are much hotter, and it will be not being able to grow much in terms of that. And the worry is for economics. We rely on Spain for a lot of our early salad crops, our almonds, our olives, all of those plantation style crops and areas of covered plastic that you often see when you travel around. The salad veg are having problems, and the trees are under stress. A lot of the almonds are under stress. They're losing quite a lot of their lemon citrus trees because they just cannot cope with endless drought.
What can we learn from what they're doing? Are there things that we can transfer?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a consumer point of view, we don't use grey water enough.
Yes,
we don't even have it plugged in. Now, they're beginning in Spain in some of the more forward thinking housing developments. They are actually separating out the grey water from the drinking water. And we really should be thinking about not putting quite good quality water down the drain.
Let's just to be absolutely clear, how would you define grey water?
It's water that has been used, say, for bathing, showering, and washing up, not obviously out of the sewage system, so not out of the loo. That's obviously in a contained self system, and it goes down a separate system in the house anyway, so you shouldn't be able to access those pipes. So yeah, it is literally water with a little bit of detergent in it. I would recommend, obviously, if you're going to do grey water and put it in the garden, that you do biodegradable, as environmentally friendly materials in it as possible, which I hope we all do anyway. But just check those labels. You don't want something that's obviously had bleach in the sink or a quite a powerful cleaner for your oven, a bleach-based cleaner for your oven. You don't want to wash that down the sink and then save that water. So initially, while you're learning your way through this, you might be looking at a bucket system that you catch that water out of your sink or your dishwasher, so you know it's relatively safe to use. But I think as we develop these systems, we become a little bit more savvy about how we're going to use the water and where we're going to store it. Because we do use, as you said, you know, 140 plus litres. And that is a lot of water to save every day. So we won't be saving everything, but I think everything that we can save reduces that tap use, hopefully.
So there are some solutions, but it would take a mass effort, and it also would take, you know, a change in legislation, I'm sure. The recent Environment Act does talk about a roadmap for water efficiency, and people are sitting up and taking notice. But I think that we've got quite a long way to go before the general public actually think about these notions of, you know, a water deficit. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it? To think we would be in deficit.
I think the only thing would change people's minds, as in California, is that water suddenly becomes very expensive. It's not a pleasant thing to think about, that you have to think about how much it costs you to turn a tap on. But when I talk to people in California before they've had the rains, when they were on their 20-year drought, they would say, well, water costs as much as electricity for us. It is too cheap a commodity. Not everybody is yet on a water meter, which I find bizarre, but it will take a shortage for people to change their behaviour, I'm sure.
What about capturing water that has been used, you know, say it has been in the bath? You know, are there simple techniques that people can use to sort of siphon that off?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how handy you are. I mean, the simplest thing, as I said, is the water in the shower, or having a siphon out the window to a bucket outside. I did see a family that caught all their grey water by literally just having a hose out the window into a water container underneath.
Yes.
And a suction or a pump or something like that to pump the water from the baths. But I think the best thing is to separate out the whole thing, because it's very difficult to get up, say, washing machines and dishwashers. There are issues about the quality of the water afterwards. It's not wise to put grey water on crops that you are going to eat. So you do have to keep it covered, and you do need to use it relatively quickly, because it is soapy, dirty water, and you probably don't want to spray that on your plants, but put it on the soil so the plants don't come into contact with it, and definitely not do that with your edibles.
So out in the garden then, what kind of techniques would you suggest in terms of the distribution of this precious resource?
I do find it bizarre that we will use expensive fresh water out of our tap to garden. So we really need to think about how we use all that water. And water harvesting, of course, is going to be key. And I'm a bit mean when I come to watering in the gardens. You know, I water thoroughly, but not frequently. And I use lots of technique. But, you know, the basics is separating out grey water to start with, harvesting as much as we can off our own roofs, garages, sheds, saving that water, and then conserving that water in the soil so it's safe there as for as long as possible. There's lots of things. You need to look at your planting plan to a certain point. When I walk along herbaceous beds in traditional gardens open to the public or whatever, in the past we would have planted herbaceous beds according to design, their appearance or colours, but we took no notice of what their requirements of water were. And when you go to some of the more water-savvy gardens in California, they are very good at separating out plants which need lots of water, plants which don't so much, and those plants which are really tough and can cope with virtually none. And you're growing those plants together. So you're only focusing your watering on a certain area of the garden.
Right. Okay. So grouping.
Lots of mulching to even minimize the amount of water that goes on the beds. Anything goes on the surface of the soil to reduce the amount of evaporation that takes place and to trap that water in. So those are things you can do before you even get to the water thing.
Yeah.
And then for me, I harvest as much water as possible. I've got a large roof. I'm lucky I've got a barn, but it could be my shed roof, garage roof. It could be a makeshift roof just to catch that water. And then you tuck that into large containers. Or if you've got a new build garden, you dig a whacking great hole and you put a 2000 litre underground container with a pump. Then you can save a lot of water that way. And that will probably get through most of the summer in a classic garden. You don't water when it's not needed. You're very savvy about how much water is in the soil. Maybe use a water meter, shove in the probe, see if it actually needs watering. In terms of watering, I think you need to be quite focused. And so I love dipping ponds or dipping containers where I can put the watering can in straight away and fill it up quickly in one go. That means I can take that and drench a plant or a bed to get that water deep into the ground where the roots need it.
I believe you don't use a hose. Is that right, Sally?
No, I have a almost three quarter acre walled garden and I don't have a hose. So it is buckets, and I love buckets. Not so much watering cans because I don't want to water the leaves. Why water the leaves? I want a bucket and I want to get the water around their roots deep into the soil. And buckets do it quickly and efficiently. And I can really drench them within a couple of minutes of my time and move on to the next bed. Because I also feel with watering, if you can achieve it quickly, you get a good result. But if you're standing around for half an hour, you're tempted to skimp because it's taking you a lot of time to do the watering. Or you pick this the hose up and then you sprinkle stuff all over the place to places where it doesn't need or on the paths. And when you superficial water, those roots are tempted to come to the surface to find that water. So you need to get the water into the soil and let it permeate down where the roots are.
And presumably you're then targeting certain parts of the garden because you've grouped your plants according to water need.
And I do a lot of gravel gardening and recycled aggregate gardening. And I did notice that Beschato Gardens, for example, in the new build estate next door, which they're planting, they are using sand over soil to reduce water loss and weeding and to make the plants more resilient. So I think they were saying something like 10 centimetres of sand goes over the soil and they plant their plants in that. Resilient plants, of course, drought tolerant ones, but that really helps the plants survive. And the other thing for me is no dig, because I don't want to disturb the fungi in the soil. Most plants that we grow in our gardens have this fungal relationship, mycorrhizal relationship with a fungus. And those fungal network of hyphae extend the area from which the plant can obtain water. So their fungus network is doing the watering for them, or is finding the water in the soil. You put the fork in, you disturb the soil, you break up the fungal hyphae, you put that plant on the back foot, you stress it because it's lost its fungal connections and it can't get as much water as it could do before. So undisturbed soils, mulched soils will help in your resilience, whatever you grow, and then before you even need to water.
So when the rain actually does come, you have a cloudburst. What are your tips for how to maximise that? I mean, obviously there's a harvesting element, but are there tricks about making that rain last in the garden?
I think with the mulching and everything that we do, I mean, I collect water by just leaving out pots and things. Collect water to maximise that. You could... it's tricky, but you could direct the water to where it's needed in the garden through the use of swales. So swales are little tiny ditches effectively, and you can direct the water down the garden, particularly if you are terraced. And you've got to be careful with heavy rain, which we might also get in between droughty periods, then comes in a huge downpour, which will just run off your garden. So you need to slow the flow to get the water into your garden. So that's permeable paths. No decking and concrete and mortared bricks. You really need to have lots of permeability so the water has the chance to sink into your garden and stay in your soil rather than running off to the nearest ditch and stream. And that will put your garden in a much better position to be more resilient going forwards to the next period of drought. So things like that, catching the water, slowing the flow, getting it into the ground, directing it to where it can collect. So a swale to take it to perhaps a rain garden, or a pond feature in your garden so you don't have to fill your ponds up. Because again, when we have long periods of drought, even my rills look quite low after 4 or 5 weeks of no rain. And so your pond will need as much of that scarce water when it does come. So direct it through little cunning drains and swales to get it into the garden where you need it to stay, rather than running out your garden or down the road to the nearest stream.
Yes. Yeah, so the rain that falls, you know, on your garden, on your house, stays somehow, and you're collecting all of it. And one other question about mulching is: many years ago, I was taught to mulch after rain. Which seems really obvious when you're talking about water in this context, but actually not necessarily that obvious when you're thinking, right, you know, it's that time of year, I've got to get the mulch in. Actually, hang on, wait till it's rained. That will just make a huge difference.
Absolutely, spot on. Mulches provide a barrier to water movement, be it out the soil or into the soil. So you do need to think about when you mulch. I use a lot of wool. On my containers, for example. So the perfect time to put wool out is after it's rained, trap that water in the soil with the mulch. So you don't want to be too early with the mulching, and make sure that you've got nice rainy period. Sadly, we had plenty of that recently, but
we certainly have. And that's a problem too, because then you get absolutely tons of it and you start to get complacent.
And the difficulty is the estimates say that we will flip from periods of very long wet weather to then flip to drought for a couple of months. Sadly for us, the pattern of rainy weather has been for 18 months, but climate change is not necessarily about Mediterranean style climate. It is more about unpredictability and extremes of weather, and being able to capture rain in an extreme rainfall period is very difficult. As much as it is to cope with drought. So they bring lots of different problems, unfortunately.
That was incredibly helpful. Thank you so much, Sally. We look forward to hearing from you again later on this year.
Brilliant, lovely. Thank you very much.
Right, now it's time to turn to some of the questions that have been sent in by listeners. And I'm here with Anton and Chris. Hello, guys.
Hiya.
Right, so first of all, what treatment do you suggest for treating box tree caterpillars? I don't have a problem yet, but I understand they're on their way. This is from John. Golly, you're not wrong there. They will definitely be on their way. So first of all, Anton, what are box tree caterpillars?
So it's a type of moth. So you either see the moths or you'll see the caterpillars. The moths are quite pretty. They're white with a black margin round the outsides. So unfortunately, when you see one of these pretty moths, you know that your box is doomed. and the caterpillars, there's greeny with black stripy black dots on them. You'll notice that they've munched most of your box away. They overwinter as sort of small caterpillars under the leaves in your box bush. And then you'll notice in about sort of March, April time, they'll start sort of munching away at the leaves. And you'll just see basically after the bush has been sort of stripped away. And you also see sort of webbing there as well. Yeah. So they have several generations throughout the year, and they'll carry on right into the autumn just munching away there.
Yeah, it's not good. I've lost all of mine, as I've mentioned several times on the podcast.
Me too.
So when did it first come here?
So apparently it first arrived in the UK in 2007, but generally gardeners started to notice it, firstly in London particularly, perhaps because there's a lot of sort of box hedging around there, in 2011. And it's gradually spread around the southeast of the country. There's been various surveys done. So they did a survey in 2015, and that covered sort of a lot of the southeast. And then by 2021, you could see that it's covering a lot more of the southeast. It's sort of creeping into the Midlands. And then you see sort of various patches in other places, some quite far north as well. So it's coming to get you, unfortunately.
Yeah.
These surveys were done by the RHS, I should probably add.
Yeah. A lot of work's been done on it because we're so in love with the plant, aren't we? And is there anything John can do to get ahead? Is there any preparation he can do to deter them? Or is it just one of those things where you just have to wait and cross your fingers?
I mean, if you've got a good bird life population in your garden, that's going to help. But I think they seem to proliferate in such sort of large numbers once you get there that I think it's going to be really quite difficult. You can do some monitoring as well. There's various sort of measures you can take against it. There's pheromone traps, which will tell you whether you'll find some moths in there. And that's really just for monitoring. It won't actually be enough to kill off the moths. So that's a sort of early warning sign.
Right, okay, yeah.
But then there's a number of biological controls that you can use. So there's a parasitic wasp that's called Trichogamma. What that does is the wasps, they're tiny little black wasps, you can hardly even see them, and they will sort of lay their eggs inside the box tree moth eggs and stop them hatching out. Mm. Instead, a wasp hatches out, they're little parasites. So they gradually sort of multiply then. So you can get these on little sort of cards or sachets that you hang on the box bush and in the foliage, and they will release these wasps for about 4 weeks. Also, there are nematodes as well, but you need to spray those directly onto the caterpillars. And you've also got to be quite careful under the conditions as well, because it's a nematode, basically, and the nematodes don't like the sunlight. And it does work out really pricey after a while. Like each treatment's about between 20 and 30 quid. That's going to really quickly mount up. And that's probably, you know, after a few treatments, you could have bought some other plants to replace
it. Yeah, I think it's fair to say we're all resigned to it here on the podcast, that the box tree caterpillars have kind of got the best of us, I'm afraid. But there are lots of alternatives. So, Chris, talk us through what you did in the past when you've had this problem.
Well, I came across it a while back when I was head gardener. I kind of understand people have this big nostalgia for box because it's kind of sort of ingrained in the English garden psyche in many ways. But I'm a big believer that if something's not working, just change it about. There's so many good plants out there that you can play around with. So I'll give you my three top tips, I think. When I was at Westminster Abbey, we did a knot garden and we had a lot of problems with box not coping. So I used a plant called Lonicera nitida. Now, Lonicera is the genus of the honeysuckle. You think of it as a climber with flowers, but this is a shrub, quite box-like leaves. There's one called Baggerson's Gold, if you want to have a bit more of a variety to it, aesthetics to it. But it just makes a great box-type hedge. And so I'd plant that in diagonal. I'd plant them about 30 centimetres apart, but I wouldn't put them in a straight line. I put them on the stagger, and it's a very fast-growing plant, so it soon fills in, okay? Give it a good mulch, give it a good composting before planting. The only downside with it, I didn't mind this too much, but some other people might, is that it grows very, very rapidly. So to keep it shaped, so if you're in a knot garden like I had it, you need to keep it trimmed all the time. You're probably out there every 3 or 4 weeks with the shears. It's quite fast-growing. So that's maybe a little bit of a warning if you're going to use it. And it's a nitida. I think it's a great plant, probably the most vigorous and strongest of the alternatives. There's another one called Ilex crenata. This is like a Japanese. Ilex is the holly genus. Actually, in the wild, I've seen it. It gets like 5 meters tall. It's a big old plant. But Wisley have done trials and used it as a box alternative. Very sort of waxy, light-coloured green leaves. We'll get fruit on it, red fruit on it, if it's allowed. Depends how often you're pruning it. But that's another one. I'm told it doesn't like very, very wet weather. So us in the UK might not be able to choose it at the moment because it hasn't stopped raining for about 6 months. But I think that's good. If you're in a sandy sort of soil, light soil, I would maybe go for that, okay? A final one would be an old classic, would be Cotoneaster conspicuous, which everyone knows a Cotoneaster, very common sort of part, front garden plant, very similar to one called Horrentalis, which everyone used to plant at one point, which grows up walls and stuff. But that is a brilliant one for bees and birds. It's probably a bit more slow growing. You'd have to clip it a bit more delicately, but I think that would be quite a nice alternative to box as well. Also, I mean, if you're a bit more adventurous, why just have a monocultured small hedge? Why not all different types of plants that stay low and undulate them and have lots going on? I think I quite like the idea of that.
And mix it up. We need more diversity in our planting. Get rid of the monocultures. There's lots of things you can do. There's all sorts of options. And you can also do a lavender hedge or a rosemary hedge.
You can even have small apple plants, you know, that dwarf apple plants, that are cordons. There's lots of stuff you can do. Don't restrict yourself.
Okay, so embrace the opportunity to branch out, I think, is the advice. So Teresa has got a question all about ants. Is there an organic way to get rid of an ant nest in my allotment? There's a large hill just outside my polytunnel, which has been there for several years. Now another smaller one has appeared inside the polytunnel. and there are signs of activity at the base of the main raised bed. So I suppose the first thing is, you know, is this something to worry about? Are ants a concern, Chris?
Well, if they're appearing at the bottom of the raised bed, it's possible that they're sniffing out some aphids. You might have aphids on a crop that's in the raised bed. And what ants tend to do is they farm the honeydew, which is basically the poop of the aphid. And they'll love that. It's very sweet. So they'll maybe come up and farm it out. So that's maybe the reason why they're appearing there. I only associated them normally. I've seen them in greenhouses where it's hot, and I've had that exact problem where they've been farming mealybug larvae or scale on plants. So you kind of need to get rid of that situation. The other situation I'm in where I need to get rid of them is my balcony, because they get into the pots. And when they're in the pots, they'll then probably come into the house. You probably don't want them in there too much. You don't need to use any sort of pesticide on them and stuff. I think obviously controlling the aphid will help. Keeping a hygienic, clean area will help. If you might want to knock those hills out and make sure they're not building up as well, so disturb the population if you like. When it comes to my containers, I actually just replaced the whole substrate. I took the plants out, took the soil down to the little woodland area, and even pulled that out and rebuilt the container. I started from scratch, and that tended to stop them coming in and work, to stop them in the balcony area. There are some sort of old gardener's tales out there, lemon juice in water, peppermint in water, white vinegar in water. I don't think that will do any damage to the ants, but it might just cause them enough discomfort to go off and live somewhere else. But that might be worth a try.
Anton, are ants good for the garden?
Well, actually, yeah, they do a lot of good in the garden. We just see them as a nuisance, but I think they get a bit of a bad press. They're very good at breaking down material. I often hear people complaining that they've got them in their compost. And really, yeah, they're just helping to shred all the sort of organic matter. We'd probably be up to our knees in it if it weren't for things like ants and springtails and other creepy crawlies, which are just helping to break all that organic matter down. So, yeah, we need them as part of our ecosystem in the garden.
There is one aspect of them, you know, Chris talked a little bit about them harvesting from the aphids, but they don't actually deter or move the aphids on or eat the aphids. And, you know, their activity then stops the ladybirds coming in to handle the aphids. So if you've got an attack of aphid and you can see ants on those aphid, what should you do?
So, yeah, I've seen exactly that. I've seen a crowd of aphids, and I've seen ants sort of harassing the ladybird, stopping it getting at them. So, I mean, on something like a tree, it would be quite practical to put a grease band around the tree, and that's particularly done for rosy apple aphids and the woolly aphids as well. So, yeah, a grease band would work. Also, grease bands would work in the practical situation, like for a plant pot or for the legs of a bench in your greenhouse as well.
All right, so there are ways that you can deter them from plants and where they might be causing damage. But if you've got a nest, then we recommend trying to disturb it if you want to get rid of it. But actually, think of them as your friends. All right, Paul has got a problem with his chilies. Why is it that my chilies are never hot? I start them in the propagator, I grow them on in a 3-inch pot, then I transfer them to the polytunnel. I let them get ripe and red, but they have no heat. Last year, I grew Scotch bonnets, nice and red, but no heat. And the different chilies that I started in December in a propagator are now fruiting in my polytunnel. They're the same, no heat. Any ideas? Goodness me. Anton, well, first of all, what gives the chili its heat in the first place?
So it's a chemical called capsaicin. It's mainly found in an area of the fruit called the placenta. And so that's the fleshy tissue that's around the seeds. People often think it's actually the seeds themselves which are hot, but actually they get some of that sort of chemical from the tissue that's around it. And some of the sort of hotter varieties, particularly things like Scotch bonnet, and then some of the sort of biological warfare like Dorset Naga or Butcherlochia, have just got loads of this chemical in them. But I mean, something like a Scotch bonnet's got a nice sort of hotness as well as a nice flavour to it as well.
Yeah, okay. So we're big fans of chilies. Chris, any idea why Paul's chilies are not hot?
I don't really think it's a heat issue. It's interesting that he says he started some in December, because chilies do love a long run-up. They like, you know, I start mine in March, so they get a full season, a bit like the tomato and pepper and aubergine. They like a long run-up. It might be because he started them in December. They've been a bit too cold and they're in shock. So you can get them hot. Long run up, but they need that summer heat. They don't like it too wet. They're kind of a dry sort of climate plant. So don't overwater them because you'll get lots of fleshy green foliage and less concentration on the fruit and the heat in the fruit, as Anton has described. So give them a long run up. Make sure they're not overwatered. They might need as much heat as possible. I'd also probably pinch them out. I'd pinch out the apical bud, which is the top bud, the one that drives the plant up, so it gets a lateral growth. So you get a nice bushy plant. I'd definitely give it a little touch of seaweed extract, foliar feed, as moving on. But long run up and heat, I reckon you'll probably be you'll be successful with chilies, unless you live in Aberdeen, which maybe is maybe a bit more tricky.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because he's harvesting them a bit early by the looks of it. And actually, he really needs them to bathe in the sunshine of June, July, August, and be looking towards a sort of September harvest, I would think, or even October. You know, getting absolutely the maximum amount of sunshine on them seems to be key.
Well, I harvested all of mine. I mean, all of them in September. So I let the plant fill and all, they were absolutely covered in fruit. So I let them sit. And you also find something like Scott's bonnet will sit there green, but when the sun's on it and it's heated up and it's happy, they'll turn red. So you're also waiting for colour change as well. So let them sit on the plant, give them the whole summer, and then you crop them in the sort of September, getting onto the autumn, and then I dry them out on strings in the shed, and then I flake them, I put them in jars, and I probably got enough after the last two summers to last me well into my old age, to be honest with you.
Well, that's a long way off, Chris, obviously. Okay, well, Paul, I hope that works for you. Will you let us know, please? Because we can't bear the idea of you growing chilies that don't have any heat. Well, that's all we've got time for this time. So thanks ever so much to Chris and Anton. See you next time. Bye.
On the next Organic Gardening podcast, I'll be catching up with gardening writer and journalist Sally Nex with an episode on plastic-free gardening. Do send us in your organic gardening questions. You can contact us via our website or social media. We're at Garden Organic UK on Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, and LinkedIn. And if you're not a member of Garden Organic already, now's a great time to join. Thanks again to our sponsors, Andermatt, who also do an organic fertilizer made from plant waste, Grow Pure. Use Organic 15 for a 15% discount at andermattgarden.co.uk. And thanks too to Kevin McLeod for the music. That's it. Until next time.